This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Best and worst jobs in America. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Last weekend in April. Glad you could spend some time with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
With college grads soon to be flooding the market and high school seniors choosing their next schools, we'll identify today's most promising and least promising careers.
The eating trend that food makers seem slow to adapt to, and that's a second breakfast. Find out how it developed.
The unique Tinder profile of a male seeking a mate in Kenya. He hopes that any potential partners are not intimidated by size, since he's 6 feet, 5,000 pounds.
And the trend behind obituary writers unafraid to air all the dirty laundry of the dearly departed.
Well, one possibility is that people through social media have got used to sharing more personal information with strangers. And I think another reason is that funerals have become less solemn and more like celebration.
Wall Street Journal reporter James Haggerty on obit writers telling it like it was, warts and all. That story is later in the hour. Well, we start things off on a serious note. If you're a history junkie, you might be interested in a new book about the Holocaust. It's called Justice at Dachau, The Trials of an American Prosecutor. It's by Holocaust history expert Joshua Green, who's also a documentary filmmaker. Joshua, what'd you write about?
In January of 1945, a young lawyer from Birmingham, Alabama, was invited by the judge advocates to come to Germany to prepare the largest legal enterprise in recorded history. This was the trial of operators of Hitler's concentration camps. More than 1,600 were awaiting trial on the grounds of the former Dachau concentration camp. Those trials successfully led to the imprisonment, the guilty verdicts and imprisonment of war crimes criminals from the Nazi Party. However, the big scandal of this period in the post-war years was that because U.S. priorities shifted away from punishing Germany to winning Germany's allegiance against the new common enemy, namely Soviet Russia, All of those convicted Nazi war criminals were let go in clandestine reversals of sentence.
Is that right?
Yeah, but it's one of the greatest embarrassments in our military history, and practically no one has ever heard of these trials.
Wow. So who was the lawyer?
William Denson was a God-fearing, handsome legal scholar born in Birmingham in 1913. He taught at West Point, then went on to have a distinguished legal career in his dad's firm, and was invited to Germany to become chief prosecutor of the Dachau war crimes trials. I never met the gentleman. He passed away about a year before I was called by his widow, Hushi Denson, to help tell her late husband's story. Hmm. Everyone's heard of Nuremberg, but no one's ever heard of these trials.
How about that? So how many guys were we talking about here? 100-something?
Well, Denson himself successfully prosecuted the accused in what were known as the parent trials. Those were the four initial trials of the operators of the camps liberated in the American zone, Camp Dachau itself, Camp Flossenbürg, Camp Mauthausen, and Camp Buchenwald. And there were a total of 177 accused in those four trials, and all were found guilty as charged.
Man. We're speaking with Joshua Green, Holocaust history expert, and he's written a book called Justice at Dachau, The Trials of an American Prosecutor. So whatever happened to those guys who were convicted, jailed, and then ultimately released as the U.S. Tried to seek Germany's alliance following World War II?
Gordon, most of them died quite comfortably in their beds. A few of them, such as the infamous bitch of Buchenwald, Ilse Koch, who had been the wife of the commandant of the Buchenwald camp, was retried by the German government in subsequent years for crimes that were outside the jurisdiction of the American Tribunal at Dachau. Otherwise, it would have been double jeopardy, and she would not have been standing trial. But the jurisdiction of the court was limited to crimes alleged against Allied nationals, so French, American, British, and so on. Denson, when he found out that all of these, the 3 years of his life was being unceremoniously just tossed out the window,
yeah,
including Ilse Koch, by the way, who was a sadistic person who used to beat prisoners and was the person accused of collecting skins from the bodies of the victims of the camps and commissioning lampshades and gloves made from their skin. When he learned that she had been one of the people let go in this series of reversals of sentence, he contacted the German government. And Denson said, try her again for her crimes against the German nationals. In other words, the German Jews who had been victims in these camps, which was not part of the jurisdiction of the American Third Army tribunals.
Oh, okay, yeah. What was Mrs. Denson's reaction as relayed by her husband, I guess, when he started to learn that all this was happening?
Well, there were two Mrs. Densons. Bill Denson was married just prior to leaving for Germany in 1945, and when he married a New York debutante, and when she realized that her husband was going to be traipsing around Germany prosecuting former Nazis, she sued him for divorce.
Oh.
And so he was kind of on his own in every sense of the term there in Germany at a party, a holiday party in Munich, which is only a few miles from the Dachau camp. He met his future wife, Huschi Denson, who was a German aristocrat by birth. She never had much appreciation for anything that Hitler was doing. And when they met, I asked her, I said, what did you guys talk about? You know, here was this tall, good-looking American who's prosecuting Nazi war criminals, and here you are, a German national, so I guess it was, you know, kind of meeting up with the enemy there. I'm not sure it was quite a legal thing being together at that party. She said we talked about the importance of integrity in law as in all things. And Gordon, I have to tell you, this is front page news. I mean, what happened to Dachau really reflects the importance of integrity and character in the execution of the law. The law is vigorous, it's robust, but it's not invincible. And it depends on men and women of good character for its proper implementation.
Thanks, Joshua, and good luck with the book. Joshua Green, again, the book is called Justice at Dachau, The Trials of an American Prosecutor. You can find more at justiceatdachau.com. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. President Trump could have taken advantage in his first 100 days of the fact that he is not an ideological conservative or traditional Republican, but rather a centrist. Wall Street Journal executive Washington editor Jerry Seib imagines a presidency that attempted from the start to take advantage of the fact that Mr. Trump is a radical centrist who should be able to create unconventional bipartisan coalitions. Jerry, explain your piece.
It's purely speculative, of course, but one wonders whether Donald Trump could have opened up his presidency, his first 100 days, in a way that might have proven to be a little less polarizing, a little less divisive, by doing a few things differently at the outset. You know, he sort of came into Washington, gave an inaugural address that pretty much indicted the political establishment of both parties in some harsh terms in some ways. And then really moved on to two things that proved to be both controversial and polarizing in the sense that they drove the two parties back into their respective quarters and corners in some ways. One was the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, and that obviously was never going to be popular with Democrats. And then there was a travel ban for seven and six Muslim-majority nations in an attempt to stop terrorism, which drew a lot of protesters out into the streets and then got blocked up in the courts. And so his biggest opening steps were in some ways not designed to, but had the effect of increasing the divisiveness of Donald Trump as a political leader. And if you step back from that and you wonder, what if he had started with, for example, a big effort to increase or to improve the infrastructure of the U.S., and maybe this big tax reform, tax cut plan that he's got in mind, which some Democrats are willing to support, at least in certain respects, would the opening have created a different climate? Would there have been the possibility of governing as a kind of a radical centrist who had risen above the partisan politics and was able to form some unconventional coalitions?
You know, it's interesting because I think there were those who said along the campaign trail that just wait, Mr. Trump won't be as divisive when the general election comes around. And then it was watch him turn presidential once he's inaugurated. It'll be a different feel. But that would be inconsistent, I guess, with what he'd been doing. But that's
distinguish between his operating style being what it is, and I think we've seen he's tempered it a little bit, but not much. But I think more what I'm talking about is his ideological or non-ideological approach. You know, he's not really a traditional conservative. He should be able to draw support from all over the place because he's kind of non-ideological and pragmatic. But he didn't really create an environment, you could argue, in the first few weeks in which that work to his benefit. Maybe it's too late, or maybe Democrats were never interested, but the question is whether, you know, it's possible still to recapture some of that populist, not ideological, I'm neither Democrat nor Republican, really, flavor of the Trump candidacy injected into the presidency.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib about his piece entitled "How an Alternative Donald Trump Opening Act Might Have Unfolded." So I think you alluded to it a little bit, but just if the priorities were different in the opening 100 days, the whole tone may be different? Like if infrastructure was the number one and not, say, repeal and replace Obamacare?
Right. It's possible. You know, I mean, by starting with the travel ban and repealing Obamacare, he chose a big initiative that, you know, first of all, was pleasing to his core base on the travel ban, and repealing Obamacare, that was a basic tenet of the Republican Party's, you know, plank or plank in its platform for the last four or five elections, or three or four elections anyway. And so that was pleasing to his party, but maybe it wasn't the sort of thing that was the highest priority for the broadest range of voters, or was designed to create a broader coalition that he could work with in the future in Washington. So, yeah, you know, if you turn the sequence of priority items upside down, you know, maybe it would have felt differently.
All right. You point to this new Wall Street Journal and NBC News poll, which talks about basic economic issues more important to Americans right now than other domestic issues, including health care. Can that still be taken advantage of by the Trump administration?
Well, that's kind of a question for the next few weeks, because what the president's going to try to do now is do both get a big tax cut plan rolling and still attempt to do the repeal and replace of Obamacare health care initiative. And, you know, we'll see whether those two things are consistent with each other and whether he can create a different kind of environment.
Thanks, Jerry. It's Wall Street Journal Executive Washington Editor Jerry Seib. It's 23 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Do you find yourself eating a second breakfast these days? After years of fretting that people had stopped eating breakfast or simply nibbled on the go, food makers and restaurants are discovering that more of us actually want to eat more than just once in the morning. How are they adapting? Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. Ellen, what's happening?
Well, what's happening is more Americans are eating the most important meal of the day more than once in the morning.
Well, that sounds good, I guess, when you place the word important next to it. But are we overdoing it, or is this a kind of a recommended course of events?
Well, what seems to be happening is that rather than eating two full-size meals in the morning, Americans are splitting it up. So in the race to get out the door in the morning, or perhaps you're either rushing kids off to school or rushing to a workout, let's say, or to start your commute, you might have something light on the way out the door. And then once you get settled, let's say at your desk, you might have something more substantial. Hmm. Or some people do the reverse. They have a substantial breakfast first thing in the morning, and then late morning tend to have another lighter snack, or in some cases what they nickname a second breakfast, and all of this happens before lunch.
Wow. This is a fairly new thing?
Well, it's funny. It's been going on in Europe for ages. Even hobbits enjoy a second breakfast. Americans, certainly farmers, ranchers, and shift workers who, you know, have very early starts to their day would be eating two breakfasts. But for mainstream Americans, this is something that has really picked up in recent years.
How about that? All right. So what is it that we're eating typically as a second breakfast, or a hashtag second breakfast, as you mentioned?
Food companies told me that what we crave between our first and second breakfast can change. And a second breakfast often tends to be slightly more savory. So General Mills, for example, told me about when they introduced their new product, Yoplait Dippers. They knew that they could go slightly more savory with the snacks that they sell alongside some of these Greek yogurts. So they sell things even like tortilla chips or oat crisps, because that second breakfast tends to be a little more savory. I also talked to the wonderful company. They sell pistachios, and they are introducing this month these new snack packs, and they're hoping that making these individual-sized portions will make people eat them more at work and try to break into that morning snack time.
Wow. Did you say, too, that some companies are not actually keeping up or are kind of late to this trend?
Well, it seems to have caught some food companies by surprise, because for some time in recent years, they've been focusing on trying to get us to eat breakfast food all day long. So, for example, cereal at dinner or oatmeal for an afternoon snack. And so now they are focusing in on the fact that Americans do not only want to eat breakfast — that was a worry they had for some years — but they want to eat it more times in the morning.
Thanks, Ellen. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. The powerful performance and incredible battery life of new Dell PCs with Intel Core processors empower small business employees to do their best work wherever work takes them. Dell's U.S.-based small business advisors and price match guarantee mean you'll always get the best deal on the right solution tailored to your business needs. Powerful PCs are just the beginning of a great partnership. Call 877-BUY-DELL now to contact a Dell small business advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL. Thanks for being with us. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, best and worst jobs in America. Also, more obituary writers really telling it like it was, warts and all. And Kenya's last northern white rhino gets a Tinder account. We'll explain why in about 20 minutes. Well, studies indicate that kids who learn the fundamentals of financial education are more likely to save money, go to college, and ultimately have a better outlook on life. As part of National Financial Capability Month, the American Bankers Association Foundation is organizing banker volunteers to visit classrooms across the country and teach children how to become lifelong savers as part of its Teach Children to Save program. We're joined now by Corey Carlisle, Executive Director of the American Bankers Association Foundation. Corey, thanks for being here. You know, I cover this story almost every year. Are we making any progress in getting schools to teach this stuff?
You know, I think we are, Gordon. It's an important topic, and regardless of the progress, we still need to talk about it.
Is there one school or a couple that you point to when you make speeches or swap emails with somebody about, I don't know, a program that you just love in a particular school?
You know, I think the programs I love the most are the ones where there's the most active engagement in the classroom. The folks that come in and try to find new and innovative ways to get kids interested in the subject are always going to be the most successful classrooms to teach the subject. You know, some people have often told me, if you want to put a kid to sleep, you know, talk financial literacy. But when you talk to kids, and I can't think of what's unfortunate in this country is that only about 17 states even require high school students to take a course in personal finance, despite the fact that overwhelmingly, you know, when kids ask, well, why are we ever going to need this subject? I can't think of, you know, we teach our kids how to be good participants in society and understand their civic role, but we don't teach them how to be good, you know, citizens in the financial world. And those the consequences of not having the fundamentals early on can really be devastating later on in life.
Yeah, my son's in high school, and he just had a personal finance course, which I was greatly relieved at. You know what I found? It just led to so many conversations because he had questions beyond that. And I thought, boy, if nothing else, it's a great conversation starter. But how much of that falls on parents? Because it's easy to blame the schools. Like, hey, you don't teach this. But really, I mean, we could be doing more as parents, I presume.
That's right. It really needs to come down to everyone needs to take this conversation seriously. And we, as bankers, believe that parents are an integral part of this discussion as much as the schools. Because, and sometimes, like your own example, the kids come home and they want to discuss these topics with their parents. Even though I know a lot of parents that are reluctant to talk about money with their kids, it's a difficult subject. Sometimes parents have their own struggles with money, so they're reluctant to talk about it. But nonetheless, we feel that having those open and frank discussions with your kids about your own financial decisions you're making on a day-to-day basis really helps impart those skills. Because kids watch their parents. They learn from our parents about the priorities they place on what to do. And they also can learn from mistakes. Nobody's perfect, and it's important to talk about those mistakes, how we learn from them. If nothing else, I'm sure a lot of parents would want to make sure their kids aren't making the same mistakes they made later on in life.
We're speaking with Corey Carlisle, Executive Director of the American Bankers Association Foundation. We're talking about their program, Teach Children to Save. Somebody tweeted me the other day that he didn't learn how to write a check until he was in college. Based on that, what would you say are the simplest things that kids should know as, say, teenagers?
Sure. So, well, I'm not sure how many checks anybody's going to be writing too much longer.
Right.
But you know, the lessons cover the basics of savings, as well as how to create a budget, distinguish. The really important thing for especially kids at an early age is understanding the difference between needs and wants, right? Understanding that needs are things that you need today, food, shelter, clothing, versus things that you want, like that new you know, Xbox from Microsoft or something. Not that that's a wonderful thing to think about, but it's obviously a great savings goal for a lot of kids who might have their eye on it. You know, but those conversations get more nuanced as we get older. I certainly know a lot of adults that could use the lessons in needs versus wants. But teaching those early on to kids at an early age, because bankers really benefit from a strong financial education. They know firsthand that it's so important we do our part in equipping the next generation with the money skills necessary to be successful later on in life.
Yeah, very good. Hey, thanks for a few minutes. Nice talking to you. Corey Carlisle from the American Bankers Association Foundation. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Looking for a career? The jobs website careercast.com is out with a list of the best and worst jobs for 2017. I'll wait just a moment while you go get your high school kid. Or college kid. Here's online content editor Kyle Kensing at CareerCast. Kyle, start with the best.
You're looking at a lot of STEM careers, so you're talking science, technology, engineering, and math. And math especially being a big one this year, where you've got statistician at number one, you've got mathematician in the top five, and you've got data scientist in the top seven with those three. So you've got three math careers there at the top.
Wow, yeah.
You're talking about a lot of income potential and a lot of high growth right now.
Boy, yeah, it's impressive. And also, a couple of new ones to the list. And not only new, but top three. You got medical services manager and operations research analyst. What's this medical services manager do?
So with a medical services manager, you're talking about sort of the business and finance end of healthcare. And that's sort of the almost forgotten part of the industry, I believe, when you talk about healthcare jobs. I mean, obviously, as consumers and patients, we know about the business end of healthcare. But it's not necessarily the kind of thing that you get a lot of talk about as far as the job market goes. And obviously, it's a huge cornerstone. You know, you have these patients coming in who, you know, you have to process insurance. You know, if you're running the financial end of a healthcare provider, having that as streamlined as possible makes for the best practice possible. So it's sort of working hand in hand with the healthcare side and the finance side.
We're speaking with Kyle Kensing, online content editor at careercast.com. All right, so when you get to the bottom ones of your 200, talk about the worst jobs in America, when you start seeing that minus sign in front of some of these numbers indicating a negative growth outlook until the year 2024, boy, that's just unsettling. Also in there too, retail salesperson and advertising salesperson. What's up with sales? I mean, this is the revenue. This is the engine here.
Exactly. And with advertising sales, you're actually kind of seeing the ripple effect a little bit, or the tying into of decline in another field. Because in something like newspaper reporter having declining outlook, or broadcaster, those are two industries that employ a high number of, or at least they used to employ higher numbers of advertising salespeople, because that's what drove those outlets. And as those positions kind of dwindle a little bit, then obviously there's going to be fewer advertisers working in those positions as well. So you're looking at a declining hiring outlook for that position. And the pay isn't necessarily great until you get to that higher level of advertising sales. And as far as retail, this is something that's sort of interesting. In March of 2017, the decline in the retail industry has actually been really steep. It was something like, I believe, 89,000 down from about a year ago. So the retail industry has seen a pretty substantial dip in recent years. I think part of it is due to people shopping online more.
Yeah.
You know, for example, I know I have friends who order things like paper towels as part of their Amazon delivery rather than just going to the store and purchasing it. So there's fewer of those jobs, and those also are also low-paying jobs as well.
Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Kensing, online content editor at careercast.com. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org, because helping business grow is pure Michigan. Thanks for being with us. Well, once generic and reverent, more obits and remembrances written by family members include frank, humorous assessments of lost loved ones. This weekend's Jennifer Kashenka has a look at what's trending in obituaries.
When you die, would you like to be remembered as cantankerous or a pain in the butt? Probably not, but more and more obituaries are starting to tell it like it is, or was. James Haggerty, The Wall Street Journal, has written an article called Haze the Dead, More Obit Writers Tell It Like It Was, Warts and All, and joins us now. James, why the trend toward the truth?
Well, one possibility is that people through social media have got used to sharing more personal information with strangers. And I think another reason is that funerals have become less solemn and more like celebrations, and people get up and tell funny stories about the deceased. And more people probably realize that it can be helpful to laugh a bit and not pretend that things were perfect.
How have obits changed through the years in terms of newspaper side?
Well, I think that's another factor. You know, in the old days, newspapers had bigger staffs, and they wrote a lot of obituaries, even for ordinary people. But today, most newspapers write only about the most prominent people. So that leaves it to the family, usually, to write the obituary. And family members are not professional obituary writers. They improvise. Most of them, in fact, write pretty dull stuff with just the usual platitudes, but some of them get quite creative and make a portrait that is warts and all and really shows the personality.
Do people, family, sometimes get in a little trouble for some of the more honest things they're saying?
I think there's that danger. In a couple of cases, people told me that they'd written the obituary and then let the family vote on it. And in some cases, I think some family members are bent out of shape. But usually, when you put in a little bit of honesty, you also put in a lot of comforting stuff and mention all of the virtues as well. So that makes the whole thing go down much more easily.
Do you think these things are also, you talked about social media earlier, can they be passed around as social media stories of interest, do you think?
Well, that's another theory, that people might want the obituary to go viral as a memorial to their loved one. In any case, it's much more likely to be read and remembered if it's a bit of fun.
More people are also writing their own obituary. Is this something new?
I think it is something that has increased a bit, and I think it's a great idea. After all, nobody knows you like yourself. And what often happens is when somebody dies, the family must suddenly come up with an obituary, and often they don't know some of the key details, exactly where the person was born or what schools he or she went to.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter James Haggerty. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us on this final weekend in April. Back to work on Monday, and we start the month of May. Well, like many guys using the Tinder dating app, Sudan loves the outdoors and travels widely. The catch? He's the world's last male white northern rhino and desperately needs to mate. Reuters says conservationists are hoping that Sudan's Tinder profile will help them raise enough money for a $9 million fertility treatment, as all attempts at getting him to mate naturally have failed. Scientists would use Sudan's sperm to fertilize an egg from one of the two last northern white rhino females. The embryo will then be implanted in a surrogate southern white rhino, a far more common species. At the conservancy in Kenya, they tried to get Big Sudan to mount the female there with park rangers even guiding him. Hey, listen, you can't force chemistry, right? The Tinder profile for the rhino reads, "I don't mean to be too forward, but the fate of my species literally depends on me." It says, "I perform well under pressure. I like to eat grass and chill in the mud. 6 feet tall, 5,000 pounds, if that matters." That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.